The Adventures of Captain Harvey, Part 4, Chapter 1, in which Harvey hears an apology. Quote, "He generally hid in the reference room, looking at flags of different countries in the front of the dictionary." Kurt Vonnegut, Jr., from his short story, Who Am I This Time? When the plane touched ground in Athens, Harvey was drawn with the passengers up the gangway to the gate. "Athens," thought the captain, looking up from the manuscript he was reading. "I'm going to Athens. Surely the gods must be with me." He continued to read as the plane soared into the night. From the gate, Harvey was led to the baggage claim, then to customs, then to the airport lobby. Near the taxi stand outside, he saw a group of men with hand-painted signs advertising places to stay. The most forceful of the bunch took control of Harvey's personality and led him to a one-star hotel. The trip through the city was a shock. Harvey had grown accustomed to the peaceful familiarity of Salt Lake City, and the congested metropolis of Athens made him feel awkward and insignificant. In Utah, he had become someone. He had friends and was cared about, but here he was just one more wanderer, of interest only to those who sold food and shelter. When they reached the hotel, Harvey's room seemed a mirror of himself. It was small and poorly lit, and didn't show a single sign of being cared for. It was valuable only as it brought in money, and was a worthless encumbrance when empty. There was a bed in one corner, and the hollow of its sagging mattress called him to sit down. Lying back with his head against the wall, he could see a door on the other side of the room. It had been nailed shut, and its window was covered with spray paint. A weak light shone through where the paint was thinnest, and as he stared, a variety of shapes began to emerge. First, he saw the Milky Way. Then he saw clouds and rivers and seas. Then there was a succession of shapes, one form evolving into another, until finally a face appeared. Vague yet clear, horrible yet handsome, it seemed to repeat the features of the captain, and as he moved across the room, he could see that its hair had been mussed, so he smoothed it with his hand and went out for a walk. As soon as he stepped out of the hotel, he saw, or thought he saw, for it was scarcely visible through the blanket of smog, the Temple of Athena atop the Acropolis. The walk through the congested city was by no means pleasant, but Harvey, with his eyes fixed on the temple, was oblivious to the noise and fumes. In fact, he did not even pause when a man showed him a photograph of a naked woman, and asked if he would like an all-night fucka-fucka. When he reached the foot of the Acropolis, he started up the zigzag path on the western slope. There were a number of tourists coming down, and he was almost inspired to follow them, but Athena kept him moving upward until he reached the terrace of her temple. He paused there, with the city spreading out around him, and raised his arms to the polluted sky. "Come, ye muses, born of Zeus and memory's mother, come to this spot where Ictinus and Callicrates have honored the most honorable of the gods. Come, dear muses, and grant my author the skill and spirit to manage the project at hand, and compose the song of my steps as I return to the future." When the seat belt light went off, the captain paused from his reading and made himself comfortable for the flight. The attendants were passing with the beverage cart, and Harvey took a mini-bottle of ouzo. With drink now in hand, he returned to reading Chapter 1. The captain went on, invoking the gods of artistry and courage, until dusk came and a security guard sent him on his way. Walking back to the city, he passed through a series of streets and alleys that were lined with souvenir stands, sporting a colorful assortment of flags, clothes, and handmade trinkets. The proprietors came to life when they spied a potential customer, and Harvey was pulled mercilessly from one stand to another. Eventually, he found himself holding a small figurine with an enormous phallus, carved in the likeness of himself. Haggling with the moxie of a native, he managed to get 14 of the figures for the price of one. He continued down the street, his pockets full of figurines and phalli, until he came to a small open-air theater. When he peeked through the gate, he could see about 100 folding chairs arranged on an earthen floor, and a young woman setting up to sell tickets. She noticed the curious captain, and was going to tell him she was not yet ready, but when he reached into his pocket and took out a figurine, she quickly pulled him in. Soon the rest of the audience began to arrive, and before long the courtyard was overflowing. Young couples and families bustled about, picking out seats, children hung from the trees, and young men gathered in groups, striking poses in front of the stage. The spectacle they had come to see was a presentation of the Shadow Puppet Theater, performed by the world-famous Haridimus. Footnote. The Greek tradition of the Karagiotsis had its first performance in 1799. Developed from the Oriental Shadow Theater, its sets and characters are similar to Turkish prototypes of the 14th century. In ancient times, the puppeteer had been called the healer of souls because of the theater's therapeutic and cathartic nature. However, during the war years, and with the advent of cinema, the popularity of Karagiotsis waned until most of the masters had passed away. Back to the text. Karagiotsis, the hook-nosed figure with a powerful right arm, was the central character, and the limits of his world were marked by his humble hut to the left of the screen and the palatial seraglio to the right. Footnote. In later years, the hut was given a television antenna to give it an air of modernity. Itzhal Zimler, in his book Prototypes, Similarities, and Other Leaps of Faith, Smith and Young Printing, Exile, Missouri, gives the seraglio a prominent place in the history of Mediterranean architecture. On page 14, he writes, "The Greek seraglio found in the Karagiotsis puppet theater became the prototype for a great number of castles and palaces along the Mediterranean coast, especially in Liguria of northern Italy." Back to the text. Haridimus was one of the last great masters of the art, and his most popular plays, often attended by a number of famous personages, were Karagiotsis the Baker and Karagiotsis on the Moon. Tonight's double feature began with Karagiotsis and the Raven. The crowd fell silent as the theater lights dimmed, then broke into applause when the first shadows crossed the screen. In order to intuit the realities to which they referred, it was necessary to remember which character was which and in what order they appeared. Haridimus was a master of handling the puppets, and Harvey admired his interpretation of the different personalities of the players. But he was forced to admit there was nothing even remotely novel about the play. In fact, it was the sentimental retelling of an age-old story. Two impetuous youths fall in love, and their illusion is shattered when the heroine suddenly dies. The only scenes that offered any pleasure at all were the ones in which Karagiotsis would pause to enjoy his nargile, for they reminded the captain of happy times at the treehouse lounge. But the tedium of the first play was nothing in comparison with the failures of the second. It was Haridimus's latest creation, an adaptation of a Pirandello masterpiece, which was altered and renamed A Karagiotsis in Search of Himself. It began at the seraglio in which the heroine of the first play had died, then took to the open road as Karagiotsis began his search. The pace was extraordinary, keeping the protagonist moving from time to time and place to place, but even with its old tricks and futuristic technologies, it became apparent there was a complete lack of substance in the main character, and that his journey was superfluous. The entire tale, it seemed, could have been told in a single scene containing a mirror and a man. But Harvey stayed until the end, and when he rose to leave, he felt he had been sitting for a million years. Stepping out of the theater, he was drawn into an alley that led back up the hill. He followed it until he came to a small cave. There was an old man in the back, sitting on a bed of rags and sipping a drink. "Cheers," he said, lifting his glass. When he saw the captain was not going to speak, he bent his leg and began to rub it with his hand. "What a queer thing is pleasure," he said, "and how remarkable its relation to pain. If we run after one and grasp it, we are often compelled to grasp the other as well, like two creatures attached to a single head." "Two creatures attached to a single head," echoed Harvey. The man looked up with interest. "Who are you?" he asked, "and what are you doing here?" "What are you doing here?" echoed Harvey. "Me?" said the man. "I am awaiting the trial."
"The trial?" echoed Harvey.
"My trial," said the man. "I am accused of prying into things under the earth and things above in the heavens. I am also condemned for making the weak argument strong and for passing ideas on to others."
"Are you Roland Twelves?" said Harvey.
"No," said the man. "I am another."
"Socrates," thought Harvey, as he put down the manuscript he was reading. "Could this be the solemn sophist, corrupter of youth and shepherd to the wise?"
"O vessel of light divine," said Harvey, "humble holder of timeless truth, help this wayward pilgrim who has stumbled into your home. Enlighten his spirit and fill his mind, you who are so wise."
"Wise?" the man laughed. "In knowing I am worth nothing as regards wisdom, is it wise to show up others as pretending to know something when they know not?"
"It is the essence of wisdom," said Harvey, "just as showing them up for pretending to be someone when they are not."
"But the penalty," said the man, "is grave for neglecting what is most important to people, for not concerning myself with money and appointments and all the plots and parties which arise in the city, for believing myself too honest to pursue such things and survive. The penalty is death."
"Death?" echoed Harvey.
"Death, my friend.
But death may not be all evil, being either oblivion or a migration from this place to the next. If oblivion, it will be like sleeping a dreamless sleep."
"Ah," sighed Harvey, "a deep and dreamless sleep."
"And what person," the man continued, "if they compared that dreamless sleep with all the other nights and days of their life, could say how many sweeter days and nights they had spent? Even the king of Persia would find few to compare. And if death is like that, I call it a blessing when it comes after a life so rich as my own. But if death is a migration from this world to the next, and if all the dead are there, what greater good could there be? To share the company of Plato and Hesiod and Homer. How much would one give to converse with the king who led the invasion against Troy, or Odysseus, or Sisyphus, or a thousand other great men and women?"
"Sisyphus," echoed Harvey, thinking of his watery friend.
"It would be as if you could travel in time, being in that timeless place."
"Yes," said the man, raising his drink again.